Okay. We're up to chapter number two. Thank you, David. Chapter number two, a clean start. Obviously connected to what we've already been speaking about, but obviously also new in terms of the information. So let's jump right into it. We see a familiar phrase to begin with the chapter, Bini, my child. It's interesting, if you look at Rashi tells us that it's really a colon. It's Bini, imti kach amarai. You are only going to be my child if you accept my teachings. That's how Rashi understands it. That's pretty harsh. Meaning, I will only consider you my child if you accept what I say. If you don't accept what I say, I don't know you from a hole in the wall. You're meaningless to me, right? But it's interesting because we mentioned probably the first class that Bini is really, in this case, a symbolic expression of Shlomo Melech's perspective on who he's talking to. Because the Gemara tells us that anyone who has learned from a Rebbe, especially Rebbe Muvhak, like their main Rebbe, so they're considered that person's father, right? They've considered their child because the Pasuk tells us, V'shinantam levanecha. You should teach your child, but we already heard the V'shinantam levanecha in the other parts of Shema, also these week's Parshios. So the Gemara tells us, V'shinantam levanecha, if you can teach someone, a student, even if you're not blood related, you'd be considered their child. And that has interesting permutations, other areas of the Torah, but we'll leave it at that. If you take my words, my sayings, umitzvosai titzpon itach, and treasure my commandments. The word titzpon is the operative word there. Like tzafun, to hide. So it's like hidden. You keep a piece of it. So I have to, on this point, I have to bring in a statement from the Sfas Emes, because it's on this week's Parsha, and he quotes this Pasuk in order to understand the Pasuk in this week's Parsha in source number three. Source number three, the Pasuk tells us, Kol ha-mitzvah asher anochi mitzavcha ayom tishmrun la'asos. All of the mitzvah that I command you today, you should be, you should guard it to do. Leman tichyun or visem uvasav yishtem esaretz. In order so that you can live and prosper in the land and inherit the land. The Medrash on this Pasuk tells us that Medrash Tanchuma in source number 4 of the Sfas Emes quotes it. Chayim heim lemotzaihem. He quotes another Pasuk from Mishlei and says that someone who finds the mitzvah, someone who follows the mitzvahs, they will find life. They'll find meaning. In the source number 4, the Sfas Emes continues, Ki chiyus hakol, the life of everything, min ha-Torah mitzvos. The life of everything comes from someone who follows the Torah and the mitzvos. U'chvi ha-yegiyah b'Torah. And it's in accordance to the effort one puts into the Torah. It's not just if someone happens to have a sefer in front of him, all of a sudden he's going to get chiyus, he's going to get life. He's going to feel alive. No, you have to actually work at it. Kein motzi mamish chayim b'nafsho. You'll mamish find life in your soul. Umasav sheniskash b'chayachayim ayidei zev. V'zeh shekasuv. And that's what the pasuk means. He's commenting on this week's parsha. V'zeh shekasuv u'mitzvosai titzpon itach. And that's what it means, that the mitzvah will be treasured inside of you, or with you. Shemikol mitzvah yishar etzlo ma'at vekas. Because through every mitzvah that someone does, you capture a little bit of that mitzvah that stays with you. V'shalola asos b'regilus. And obviously you can't just do it by rote, just through the routine. Rak lios batel v'davuk l'pnimus ha-mitzvah. You're doing the mitzvah for the right reasons. V'zesh goes a kol ha-mitzvah yilash v'mitzoy. Okay, we're not going to get into his darshan of the pasuk here. But he says, fine. He goes into an interesting thing about the voice that you hear or the feeling that you have when you do a mitzvah. But the Sfas Emes says, what does it mean? When you have a mitzvah, it will stay with you. We've talked about this in other contexts. But when you do anything in the world, mamash, when you do anything in the world, it's going to have an effect on who you are as a person. So I believe the first time the Sefer HaChinuch brings up this concept is by the mitzvah of not breaking bones when you eat the Karban Pesach. There's a mitzvah to not eat bones when you eat the Karban Pesach, because the Torah also tells us that you should eat it while you're really hungry. So if you're going to eat it while you're really hungry, you might eat it very fast. So the Torah tells us, no, don't make sure to eat it slowly, purposefully, with a certain a concentration so that you don't break the bones. And the Sefer HaChinuch explains that the point of that mitzvah is to instill within all of us the ability to be polite and have good manners, right? And he explains there that achrei ha'pa'ulos nimshachos halavavos, that after one's actions comes one's heart, which is really if anyone here is familiar with modern psychology, so it's really at the core of what we call CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is that there is a symbiotic relationship between our actions and our psychology. That it's not just when we think about something it affects our actions, but also when we act it affects our thinking. So says the Sefer HaChinuch, and says the Sfas Emes, interpreting our first pasuk here, mitzvah secha titzpo nitach. When you do a mitzvah, it's going to stick with you. You're going to have some of it. You're always going to hold on to some of that treasure. So that's what it means. And treasure up, you're going to titzpo, you're going to hide it away. You're going to have it forever when you do a mitzvah. Then Shlomo HaMelech continues, l'hakshiv l'chachma aznecha, to listen, to be attentive to wisdom with your ear. Or to be attentive with your ear should be attentive. Tatel libcha litfuna. And you shall incline your heart to understanding. Ki im labina tikrad latfuna titein kolab. Because if it's understanding that you're calling out for, so then tivuna, you should give out your calling. We'll see exactly what that means. If you search it like silver, and if you seek it like silver, and you search it like treasure, so then you will understand the wisdom of God, the knowledge of Hashem, you will find. Okay, so a lot of interesting poetry here that we have to break down. So first of all, let's just go through the different psukim. First we had doing mitzvot, so you'll keep them. Listening to wisdom. We had gaining understanding. We had searching for it like money. And then you'll understand it. You'll understand the fear of God. So there's interesting corollary to this in the Mishnah of the sixth parak of Avos, which is not really part of Avos, but was added to Avos because it's before Shavuos. So it says there, the Torah is acquired in 48 different ways. So it starts first by saying, study, attentive listening, proper speech, and an understanding heart. So what's interesting is that we actually have four of those in these four psukim. First, we have in the second pasuk, l'hakshiv l'chachma aznecha. That's by listening, attentive listening. Then you have, im labina tikra latzvuna titin kolecha. To understand, you should give your voice. That's by proper speech. And then you find, im tevakshenet hakesef, ramon matech psena. We'll get in a second what that means. As tavin yiras Hashem. That when you search after it like money, just to give a little bit of a taste of what we're going to say, you search after it like you desire it. So that's your heart. That's your desire. That's an understanding heart. And then you have the intelligent heart, tzichlos halev, which could be das Hashem, which is the last part of the first source. But just an interesting parallel for some food for thought. But if we go down to source number 5, we'll find Rabbeinu Yonah's commentary on this second pasuk, which is to give your ear. And the way that Rabbeinu Yonah says it is going to be maybe it'll conjure up memories for you, but it certainly conjures up memories for me. The very first thing you need to do in order to find wisdom, that you first have to give your ear and listen to the people that are teaching in order to that are teaching it the right way. And you should have intent in your listening without any other externalities. V'yesh anashim, and there are some people, she'einam mechavnim l'shmuasam, that aren't really paying attention when they're listening, v'yosifu le'v'yigru mimena, and they add their own flavor to what they're hearing. They add their own preconceived notions to what they're bringing into their mind. Viosifo leather, adding something to it. Viyigru mimena. And then by adding to it, they're taking it away. Or they might be adding or taking away, just as a plus-minus game. But then he says, Gam yidmu lepamim sheshamu alav hein. And when they add their own interpretation, their own thinking about it, so they'll start to think that the things that are bad are really good, vial hein lav, and the things that are good are really bad, vial aser mutter, and the things that are forbidden are really permissible. That when someone's not properly paying attention, so then they're going to have misled by their own preconceived notions, which is really fascinating. There's a book that I wanted to bring in here, but I didn't bring it in. There's a book by I think his name is Isaac Lipsky. Anyone ever heard of Isaac Lipsky? He's blind, but he has a book that's called Eyes Wide Open, and he talks about how it's only once he became blind that he truly learned to understand things. Because all the time that he was seeing, so he would attribute his preconceived notions of how the world worked based on his sight without truly understanding something. And it's only once he lost that ability to see that he truly understood the things around him. It's a very fascinating thesis. But the point that I want to make here, beyond that point that we've already made before, I think a few weeks ago, is the difference between two types of listening. Because as my father used to say, when he would start off his basketball clinics, he has two rules. One is you have to listen, and the other is you have to pay attention. Because there are two types of listening. There's listening in order to just hear the sound waves go through your eardrum, and then there's a paying attention, which is trying to imbibe or trying to comprehend and really understand what a person is telling you. This reminded me of a fascinating study I once read and I once spoke about a few years ago, which I call the Xerox study. I don't know what it's actually called. But it was a pretty famous study back in the 80s, at least. Ellen Langer published a research study about the power of the word because. It wasn't really about the word because, it was more about mindfulness, but we'll see how this article is portraying it. Langer had people request to break in on a line of people waiting to use a busy copy machine on a college campus. Remember, this is the 70s, there weren't computers and printers, people did a lot more copying back then, so there were a lot often lines waiting to use a copy machine. I don't know, anyone familiar with this? Yeah, no one's ever made a line at my copy machine, that's all I can say. But okay, so people used to make lines by the copy machines. The researchers had the people use three different carefully worded requests to break in line. I actually put the requests out of order in order for it to make a point. Excuse me, I have 5 pages, may I use the Xerox machine? That was one request. Excuse me, I have 5 pages, may I use the Xerox machine because I'm in a rush? And then the last one, excuse me, I have 5 pages, may I use the Xerox machine because I have to make copies. Okay? Those were the three different phrases, that the three different questions they would ask a bunch of different people. A few hundred people they asked this question to. Did the wording affect whether people let them break in the line? Here are the results. Does anyone want to say it before they see it, what they think the results are going to be?
I would have thought the second one would get the best result.
Right, right. Can I use the copy machine because I'm in a rush? You would think that's the best result. So let's see what happens. Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine? 60% compliance. They list 60% of the time. Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine because I'm in a rush? 94% compliance. Excuse me, I have 5 pages. May I use the Xerox machine because I have to make copies? Also, 93% compliance. What's interesting about that?
What's the difference between the first and third?
The first and the third are the same thing. The person's clearly coming to make copies. It's just that the person said the words, because I need to make copies. Which was obvious, because he said, I have copies to make. Right? It's just the fact that the person gave a reason, which allowed someone to start thinking about what they were saying to them. Right? If you look, you're using the word because and giving a reason resulted in significantly more compliance. This was true even when the reason was not very compelling, because to make copies. The researchers hypothesized that people go on automatic behavior or mindlessness as a form of a heuristic or a shortcut. And hearing the word because followed by a reason, no matter how lame the reason was, not my words, how lame the reason is, causes us to comply. Really, it's not about compliance, it's more about paying attention.
It depends on where you are. I'd say where I use the word, okay, because I'm in a rush, uh-huh, that would have had the least compliance.
Really?
Okay. They want to stick it to you.
That's right. Why are you
also in Russia?
Right. Okay, interesting. But the point of this study, for me, further, there are many different points that can be taken out of this, but the people that are listening to these statements, so the person that listens just to the phrase, I've got 5 pages, can I use a Xerox machine, is just instinctively saying, no, I'm in line. Or at least 40% are saying, no, I'm in line. It's good that 60% said yes, meaning they were thinking enough to say yes. But once you add the word because, all of a sudden people have to comprehend. They have to put two things together. Right, because in a second clause makes you connect it to the first clause. And you have to start thinking about what the person said. And just that trigger, that someone has to start thinking, allows the person to actually understand better what the cost-benefit analysis is. And this person doing 5 copies is not that big of a deal. What I find interesting about this, by the way, is they only ask the next person in line if there's really a line. So you're cutting 20 people. You're not just cutting one person. But that's for a different time. I always got upset about people, you know, in school, in day school, where someone would say, hey, can I cut you? They're not just cutting that person. They're cutting everybody else behind them. You have to ask everybody. So this is the point that I think Rabbeinu Yonah is saying, that there is different types of listening. Halahakshiv l'chachma aznecha means to really pay attention. It's not just to listen. It's not just lishmoa, but it's l'hakshiv l'chachma aznecha, to really comprehend and try to pay attention to what's going on. Now the next pasuk is open to interpretation, but we're going to use it in one way that we've used that we've talked about before, but with a little bit more depth. Ki im la bina tikra. If you want to understand, or if you're calling out for bina, for understanding. And latzfuna titen kolecha, then how does it translate? If you call to understanding and cry aloud to discernment. Okay? It's basically saying the same thing. Most of the mefarshim on this pasuk talk about how we say in Shemona Esra, atacho enein la'adam das, that if we want to be smart, if we want to really to attain wisdom, so the only person that's going to give it to us is Hashem. Hashem is the one that gives us the ability to truly be wise, and that's what it says, im labina tikra. If you want wisdom, tikra, call out for it. Ask Hashem. Give it, graciously provide from you some of your wisdom. And while that's definitely true and probably more literal, the Radak has an interesting interpretation, which for some reason I can't find the Radak and I can't quote it for you. But I saw it in this book over here. That Mr. Fisher brought for us, that the Radak is brought down to say that what it means here is im la bina tikra. If for understanding you're calling out, how, what should you do? Latvuna titen kolecha. You want understanding, so give your voice towards understanding. What does that mean? Says the Radak, it means if you want to gain wisdom, you have to teach wisdom. What does that mean? We've talked about this before. But in a very simple way, what it means is the best way to learn is to teach. There's no better way that you can inculcate wisdom than actually trying to teach it to somebody else. Because as we'll see, teaching it forces you to really understand it. If you look here, I found an interesting article on time.com. I didn't know there was such a thing, but there is. Same as the magazine. And I really like it for the end, so pay attention till the end. In what scientists have dubbed the protege effect, student teachers score higher on tests than pupils who are learning only for their own sake. But how can children, still learning themselves, teach others? One answer, they can tutor younger kids. Okay? This is fascinating. I find this, the next page.
Montessori?
I don't know. I have no idea what it means. But this is what they did, some people did, in order to facilitate this disability. But the most cutting-edge tool under development is the teachable agent. I've never seen this myself, but a computerized character who learns, tries, makes mistakes, and asks questions just like a real-world pupil. Engineers and computer scientists at Stanford and Vanderbilt universities have created an animated figure they call Betty's Brain, who has been taught about environmental science by hundreds of middle school students. Even though users' interactions with Betty are virtual, the social impulses that make learning by teaching so potent still come into play. Student teachers are motivated to help Betty master the material so that they study it more conscientiously. As they prepare to teach, they organize their knowledge, improving their own understanding and recall. And as they explain the information to her, they identify knots and gaps in their own thinking. Right? You can't give something over unless you really understand it yourself. Above all, this is my favorite part, it's the emotions elicited by teaching that make it such a powerful vehicle for learning. Student tutors feel chagrin when their virtual pupils fail. When the characters succeed, they feel what one expert calls by the Yiddish term, nachas. I have no idea how she's pronouncing this word, but obviously we know what it means, nachas. Don't know that word? I had to learn it myself. Pride and satisfaction that is derived from someone else's accomplishment. I didn't look up nachas. It was in the article. So what does it mean? When you have the opportunity to teach, it first of all makes you, it forces you to really know your stuff. It forces you to really know how to give it over, but it also, once you don't know how to give it over, you'll know where you're missing and you have to fill in. But most importantly, when you teach somebody else, and I tell you this is, if I had to be honest with myself, probably one of the major motivators as for me as a teacher is the ability to see and to intuit the appreciation other people get when they are taught something, when they can learn something. And it says, as it says here, you get nachas from the ability to give over. And what that does effectively is it motivates you to know the information better. Right? When I give a drasha, my main impetus for giving it over is the main motivation for me to prepare well is so that other people can understand what I'm saying. And similarly, oftentimes people, not oftentimes, but people have asked me in the past, you know, what gets me emotional and passionate when I speak, when I teach, when I do anything in this form like this. So one of the main motivators is really me trying to sell the material. Well, whether that's a good motivation or not, it might be a low lishma motivation. But when I approach teaching, and I hope other teachers feel the same way, when I approach teaching, oftentimes it's in the perspective of I have something really good that I want to give over, and I have to be the salesman so that other people also recognize that it's really good. Right? So when I'm teaching, when I'm giving those over these ideas, it's because I want you to know them. And for you to know them, I have to really sell it. So there's an interesting benefit to me and to any teacher when they have to give it over this way. And that's what it means when the teacher, when Shlomo Melech says, "Im la bina tikra," if you're calling out for wisdom, "la tzvuna titin kolecha," give out your voice in trying to teach over wisdom, and then you'll get it. When you try to teach it, yes.
It's sort of like the medical school approach of watch one, do one, teach one.
And that in order
and
to learn.
It's yours.
Right. That residency is not just putting in your time, but it's also part of the learning.
Right.
For sure.
And teaching.
Right. I guess the teaching. Right. I know a lot of doctors that are teachers now.
Right.
We've talked about that before, but it's very interesting seeing it in this context because it's really this whole section that we're doing tonight is about learning. It's about the importance of attaining wisdom. So one of the best ways, not only according to Shlomo Melech within the Radak's interpretation, but also according to modern science, modern psychology, is the opportunity to teach is what's going to drive your own learning for the myriad of reasons we just mentioned. If we continue, though, perhaps the most difficult or the most operative facet of this sort of charge that Shlomo Melech is giving to us in order to attain wisdom is im tivakshena kakesef v'chamat monim techapsena. If you seek it out like silver and you search for it like treasure. If you search for it like treasure, so az tavin yiras Hashem, right? These are all sort of preconditions in order to understand Hashem's wisdom. So what does it mean to search it out like silver and for like treasure to seek it out? So obviously we can come up with our own understanding of that. But one of the connections, again, to this week's parsha comes in the form of a pasuk we say every single day, many times a day. That's in this week's parsha. Hashem says, if you listen to the words that I'm commanding you today. Now, when did Hashem say those words? He didn't say them at Har Sinai. Right? So Rashi implicitly asks a very obvious question. What do you mean, the commandments you've commanded us today? You commanded them to us 40 years ago at Mount Sinai. And even before Mount Sinai, you were giving us commandments. What does it mean today that you're commanding us? So Rashi explains in source number 8, Sheyu alechem kadashim, ki'ilu shematim bo bayom. You should always look at Torah as if you're hearing them that day. You're hearing them right away, immediately in front of you. What does that mean to hearing them that day? To me, what that means is you have to approach Torah as if it's precious, that it's something that you haven't seen before. Why is a jewel very precious? Because they're not all over the place, right? Something which is rare is more precious. The less you have of something, the more important it is. We have this by Yom Kippur in the parsha of Achrei Mos. So it talks about the Yom Kippur service, and it says, "Bechol Kodesh Lo Yavo," or something like that, that you shouldn't go into the Kodesh HaKadashim. And then it says, "Only Ach Besor LaChodesh Hazeh." The only time you can go in is on Yom Kippur. Why does it say like that? Just say the only time you can go in is Yom Kippur. So I think Rav Moshe Feinstein explains, if I remember correctly, that through the appreciation of when you don't get something, that's how much more special it is when you do get it. But first you have to recognize you don't get it. Right? B'chol Kodesh Lo Yavo, you should never go into the base in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Only after you appreciate the fact that you should never go into this room can you finally appreciate when you get to go into it. Right? If you're just going to say you go into Yom Kippur, okay, so it's like any other room. We go into this room on Sunday, we go into this room on Monday, and on Yom Kippur we go into this room. So, no, Hashem says no. You're not allowed to go into this room ever. Appreciate the fact that it's so rare you're ever allowed to go in. And then once Yom Kippur comes, you'll realize the severity of this day. You'll realize the gravitas that this moment has. I remember when I was a kid, it used to be, I don't know if anyone did this to their kids, does this to their kids. It used to be we can never go into mom and dad's room. Ever. Right? To such an extent that it became a reward to go into their room. There was nothing special in the room. It's just the fact that we can never go in. I remember one time I was dropped off at the house and it was after like a football game in the park or something, and there was no one home. And I was in tears. Like no one home. I was fearing for my life. I couldn't get in the house. I was like 8 years old. I remember it though. And some neighbor saw me there crying my eyes out on the porch. I was like running after their car. I said, I don't know where my parents are. They took me, whatever. Long story short, when my father came home, what did he give me in order to appease me? He let me go into his room. And I watched some random sporting event in his room. That was like the great reward that I got. I just remember that because, you know, it was a thing that you weren't allowed to go into the room. All of a sudden you're allowed to go in. It becomes very special. Just by the nature of its rarity. So says Rashi, Yucha Aleich Kachadashim, that the Torah should be for you like you just met it, like you just saw it. It should be like a first date every single time you approach the Torah. You've never seen this thing before. That's how special it should be. We say by the Karban Tamid, right? Ha'asuya b'Har Sinai, right? You should do the Karban Tamid like it was done at Har Sinai. What does it mean like it was done at Har Sinai? So some of the Farshim explain, because that was the first time we ever did it. When you do specifically the Karban Tamid, which you do every single day, in the morning and in the afternoon, remember that it should be done like you did it that very first time at Har Sinai. Ka'asuya b'Har Sinai. So hopefully we take that with us. But that's where we're coming from here, that into Vakshenek HaKesef, you search it out like silver. V'chamat monim techapsana, you should search it out like a treasure in a field. The Rabbeinu Yonah explains, I don't think I have the Rabbeinu Yonah here, but the Rabbeinu Yonah explains that what does it mean to search it out like a treasure? Imagine if someone told you that you had, I guess, an $1 million check buried in your backyard. So what would you do? Maybe you would search for an hour, and if you didn't find it after an hour, would you give up? No. You would search and search and search and search and search. You'd go crazy finding, looking for it. The guy told you, I promise, I put it in there. He's a trustworthy guy. You would go on your hands and knees searching through your entire backyard until you found that check. And that's what it says here. Kamat monim techapsanu. You should never tire from searching out the Torah. You should never tire from it. The Gemara tells us in Avodah Zarah, Rabbi Yonah, I think, also quotes this in the same vein. Kim b'toras Hashem chavto amar Rebbe. I assume the Rebbe Yehuda Anasi. Ein adam lo me Torah el memakom shalibo chafetz. It's become a famous song, but a person does not grow. A person does not learn Torah except from the place where his heart desires. And this is true about anything. That if your heart is not in something, you're not truly going to retain the material. There's a book that I quoted. I believe I quoted it here before I was hired as part of my Q&A session on Sunday morning, which was supposed to be a lot worse than it was. But it turned out to be pretty good for me. And one of the stories that I quoted was from this, I think I quoted it from a book called Grit by Angela Duckworth. A really wonderful book, all about perseverance and how expertise is not inherited but gained through the ability of recognizing failure and growing from it and pushing forward. So she says one of the major themes in her book is promoting interest in what you're doing. She talks about the plight of many people who work in America who hate their jobs, and then she says the following. Consider the story of the bricklayers. Three bricklayers are asked, "What are you doing?" The first says, "I'm laying bricks." The second says, "I'm building a church." I think when I said it over, I said shul. The third says, "I'm building a house of God." What's the difference? The first bricklayer has a job. He's laying bricks. The second has a career. He builds churches. The third has a calling. Though many of us would like to be the third bricklayer, we often identify with the first or the second. Every bricklayer has the same occupation, but their subjective experience, how they themselves viewed their work, couldn't be more different. According to management professor Amy, take your best guess, Worshanevsky, research, any occupation can be a job, career, or calling. How you see your work is more important than your job title. A lot of people assume, I don't know if this is from her or from someone who's commenting on it, a lot of people assume that what they need to do is find their calling. Amy says, I think a lot of anxiety comes from the assumption that your calling is like a magical entity that exists in the world waiting to be discovered. A calling is not some fully formed thing that you find. It's much more dynamic. Whatever you do, whether you're a janitor or the CEO, you can continually look at what you do and ask how it connects to other people, how it connects to the bigger picture, how it can be expression of your deepest values. This, I think, is one of the most important things that we can do in our everyday life. And it's really hard to do. It's really hard. That every task that we have oftentimes becomes onerous because we see it just as the task and we don't necessarily see it for its purpose. So I had a woman once come to me in Kansas or email me. I have no idea how she got my email. But she came to me and said, "I'm interested in Judaism. Can I talk to you?" So, okay, one of these. Okay, so we meet at a Starbucks, and she says to me, "You know, I've been going to this church. They don't like me there because I ask a lot of questions." Okay, so I say, "Well, Judaism, we love questions. So, you know, shoot. You know, let me hear it." First of all, it's probably a mistake because, you know, a couple weeks later, she sends me an email with maybe 50 questions. And I just told her, "I don't have time for this. If you want to meet again, we can talk. I just don't have time to answer 50 questions." Either way, so one of the things she said that the church was bothered by, or the church couldn't answer for her, was how does she find spiritual meaning in her everyday life? She was a cashier at like a supermarket. And for whatever reason, she said that there was no good answer. They said, you know, that religiosity and spirituality happens in the church, and you know, your supermarket job is just a functional thing to put food on the table so that you can come to church, things like that. Which is definitely true. You know, obviously there's a functional aspect to our jobs. But what I told her is that you have to sort of change your mindset. And it's not, or I didn't tell her to, but I said one could, promote a different idea which will help you in your job and in your spirituality. That your job at the supermarket as a cashier is not simply so that you can make money. But what you're doing is feeding people. What you're doing is, you know, accounting for their livelihood, right? You are sustaining mankind, right? Just shift your perspective into a nobility, which you can understand through your job, And then your job becomes more noble. It becomes more purposeful. And even the most mundane jobs, like a janitor, can actually find their job is really a calling. And much the same way, I think of this pasuk in Mishlei. Im tevakchenek hakesef. If you search it out like money. If you search it out like silver. What do you mean, if you search it out? I either desire it or I don't desire it. He says, Shlomo Melech, no, you can choose to desire it. The question is whether or not you set your perspective in the right way that will sort of calibrate your mind to see the Torah, to see the wisdom of Hashem in a way which is important for you to seek out. And I think what Angela Duckworth really goes through, and I tried to find a better quote, but I couldn't, you know, I didn't have the book with me. I think what she goes through is the purpose of her book, Grit, meaning perseverance, basically, is not as much perseverance in order to get to the end, but perseverance in order to feel satisfaction of the persevering. Meaning, it's not the end goal which is satisfying, it's the perseverance which is satisfying. That the purpose is what motivates you every step of the way. Not just once you get to the end of the road, once you become CEO, once you make the big bonus, once you attain some great prize or reward. That's not what should motivate you. What should motivate you is the purpose that you're doing it for. And when you can really appreciate the purpose for what you're doing, so every step of the way is the achievement. The journey is the process is the real reward. And that's what Mishlei is saying. That's what Shlomo Melech is saying. When someone searches for treasure, they are excited. Every new hole that they dig, they're pining to dig it. Right? They can't wait to dig it. There's a story they say, or actually I heard, there are different versions of the story, and I don't remember the details, so I'm going to fill them in myself. But someone was once came off of a long trip and got to the place they were going, but they forgot their bag. So the, their son or a butler or someone went to go get their bags. And Rain, you know the story? No? So someone went to go get their bags. So the guy was coming, you know, he explains to them, it's a bag, it looks like this, blah, blah, blah. And the guy comes back with a bag, looks just like the person said, but he's schlepping it. And he's dragging it. And he's sweating. And he's moaning. And it's taking him forever. The guy, he comes back to him, and the guy says, that's not my bag. So what do you mean it's not your bag? It's exactly what you said. It has your name tag on it. He says, no, that's not my bag. How do you know it's not your bag? Because you're working so hard. If you would know what's in the bag, you wouldn't be working so hard. That bag is full of diamonds. If you only knew the bag was full of diamonds, you wouldn't be working that hard. That's what he says. Right? Because when we know what we're carrying, what we know what we're doing, so it motivates up in completely different ways, to the extent that it actually changes our approach to what we're doing. And obviously
diamonds are like stones are heavy.
What is it?
Diamonds are like
right, diamonds are like stones. There's a famous song. What's this song? Oh gosh, I'm gonna forget this song. There's a song based on a story that happened in, I want to say, where did the story happen? Oh my gosh, it's north of Kansas, Nebraska. I think Omaha, Nebraska. Maybe Omaha. Maybe somewhere in Nebraska. And story goes that someone, there was a family, and they had broken down or something. And the brother, there are two brothers, and one of them got so, you know, parched and starving, he couldn't walk anymore. So the other brother carries him like a few miles until they find civilization. And the storekeeper, I don't know if it was the younger brother or something, the person that they come to says, how could you possibly carry your brother? Isn't he heavy? You carried him for such a long time. So he says, he's not heavy, he's my brother. I don't know if anyone knows this, that there's like a song that was made out of this, and there's a statue. I don't know who sings the song. There's a statue of it somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah, Father Flanagan or whatever
it is. I don't know what it was, but that's the story, and it's a really beautiful story because that's what it says. If you can really appreciate that kamat monim, that what we're searching for in the wisdom of Hashem are treasures, so then it's not going to be that difficult. Az tavin yiras Hashem. Shlomo Melech finishes off and says, then you will understand the wisdom of Hashem. And according to Rabbeinu Yonah, at least, in source number 11, he says, Yiras Hashem here is a reference to the benefits of seeking out wisdom, not just fear of Hashem, but he says in Surah number 11, Tavin yiras Hashem achrei shesidir ma'alos shiasik adam ma'en as chachma, all the things that you can do in order to get chachma, to get wisdom, yidaber al pri ha-chachma, the benefits of chachma, the offspring of chachma. Va'atoelas ha-nimtza ba, ki ein me'ikra toelas ha-chachma ha-kavod shiasik adam ba, v'chashivas ha-nefesh b'yosa ba'alas chachma, v'utzvun ha-chachmas ha-tishboros va-toledas va-mazolos. It's not that someone, when they acquire this wisdom, now he's going to be honored and respected as a brilliant person because he has all this chachma. That's not the point. The point is v'hinei bi'ir b'rosh ikari ha-toles ki yasik ha-adam min ha-chachma li'yiras Hashem. When you finally gain this wisdom, you will finally be able to understand what Hashem wants from you in the world. You will gain a fear of Hashem, an awe of Hashem, and you'll be able to follow His Torah. That's really the goal. Not the attainment of wisdom. And then we'll just do a few more psukim tonight. Ki Hashem yitinchach mipiv das usfuna yitzbon laisharim toshia magin lehocheis hom lintor orchos mishpat v'derach hasidav yishmor. For Hashem grants wisdom, knowledge, and discernment are by His decree. He reserves ability for the upright, and He is the shield for those who live blamelessly. That's an interesting translation. Guarding the paths of justice, protecting the way of those loyal to Him. Rashi says a very interesting line here, which I think is very applicable in the positive and the negative. Rashi says, Ki Hashem yitin chachma, in source number 13, Halamadata, shegedolahi. Why do you know that it's such a big deal? Sharei nitna mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why do you know it's so important? Because Hashem said so. That's why you have to acquire it. Interesting, possibly circular logic here. But what it means is, when you know Hashem is great, then whatever comes from Hashem must also be great. Right? There's Gemara's about this, we'll talk about at length. But what I wanted to point out from this is something that Daniel Kahneman speaks about in Thinking Fast as well, which is a book we've talked about before. He says the following: if people are failing, they look inept. Right, you see someone who doesn't do something well, so they just look bad. If people are succeeding, they look strong and good and competent. That's the halo effect. People are familiar with the halo effect? It's a very important concept. Your first impression of a thing sets up your subsequent beliefs. If the company looks inept to you, you may assume everything else they do is inept. I cannot tell you how many times this applies throughout the day. That oftentimes, in the positive and the negative, if we have an impression about a person, it literally affects everything else that person does. Right? How often do you hear, in the political realm this gets very confusing because they do all these tricks for people. You know, if you give someone a quote and then you have to guess who said it. Yeah. Right? So the impression you have about a person will dictate what you think about what they do or what they say. Right? So they'll tell you a quote from some political figure that you know the person hates, and then you'll tell them that, tell them the quote, and they'll say, oh, I love that quote, that's what we should follow, and then they'll say, so-and-so said it, and then they're like stuck, right? Because oftentimes, we only interpret what we hear based on who's saying it, right? And it can easily go either way. Everything can be justified one way or another. We'll modify what we hear, we'll modify what we see, based on our preconceived notion of that thing or that person. And Rashi is telling us here, the only person that works for is Hashem. Right? When Hashem says something, rest assured that what He's saying is worthwhile for you to inculcate into your life. But when it comes to somebody else, always have to take it with a grain of salt. And that works in both ways. If you hear something from somebody who you don't like, so it's not necessarily the case that it's something bad. And if you hear something from someone you do like, it's not necessarily the case that you have to bend over backwards to justify how they said it or why they said it. Right? Sometimes a person can be wrong. Right, this happens a lot, and I don't know if it's a pet peeve. It hasn't crossed the threshold of a pet peeve of mine, but people will sports fans, right? They'll like a certain sports player. People do this with Tiger Woods and Kobe Bryant, right? So they're so good. People love their athletic prowess. All of a sudden, they do something really wrong, and everybody jumps to trying to figure out how we can justify that it wasn't so bad. Oh, it was consensual. Oh, he was having problems with his marriage. Oh, it wasn't really what they said it was on the news. All of a sudden, people like the person's golfing abilities, and therefore they have to justify their extramarital affairs. Why do two things have to do with each other? You, for some reason, we get connected to people and their atmosphere and their aura and their prowess, and therefore everything about them has to be great, and nothing about them can be bad.
You know what teaches? Would you like to teach that everything yeah. is wrong?
Is right. Wrong. Yeah. It goes both. It cuts both ways. Cuts both ways. Yeah, if it's a bad teacher, it doesn't matter what they do, you're going to hate it, right? And this applies in so many areas, and it's really hard to catch ourselves because it's an instinct. It's really an instinct in terms of this concept that it's important to try to catch ourselves. But at least for Hashem, if Hashem's telling us wisdom, so we have to keep it. There's one more thing I wanted to point out. The Gra mentions in his commentary, but there's no good, there is a good copy of a Gra, but I didn't put it on the sheet. The pasuk says Yitzpon laisharim toshia magen lahol chetom. So if you have the wisdom of Hashem, so it will. It says here reserves ability for the upright. I'm not really sure. Toshia is a difficult word to translate, but it will be a treasure for the yesharim, the righteous, and it will be a magen lahol chetom. It will be a protection for those who walk simply. Olchei tom, like tam, means simply. Here it has a different understanding. But what's the difference between these two clauses? It's going to be good for the yesharim, the people who are righteous. And then it's going to be a protection for those who are simple, those who walk simply. Olchei tam. One is defining a person by who they are, yesharim, the righteous. And one is defining a person by what they do. Hol chetom. Walking, people who walk simply. So what's the difference between these two? So first of all, the first one is much more positive. Yitzbon laisharim toshia. It's going to be good for them. It's going to be a treasure for them. But only a protection for those who walk simply. So what's the difference? The Gra explains that these are two separate types of good people. There's one person who goes in life and analyzes every single thing they do. They'll go into dangerous situations, they'll weigh the costs and benefits, and then they'll make the right decision. That type of person has created within themselves a moral compass, that they can go wherever they need to, and they can apply that moral compass. We've talked about this before. What was the pasuk we talked about last week and 2 weeks before? It'll be a wreath for your head, right? What was that pasuk? Atar l'roshecha? Levi aschein l'roshecha, that's what it was. Thank you. Levi aschein l'roshecha, right? That the Rabbi Yonah explains, it'll be good for your mind, for your mental capacity when you understand the ways of God. Because then any situation you go into, you'll be able to apply it. So the first part, says the Gra, Yitzvon la'yisharim. The yisharim are the people that have created, that they have calibrated for themselves a moral compass that they can apply everywhere. They are righteous in the way that they go. They are yisharim. They always go on the right way because they know how to decide which way is the right way. But Hol Chetam, what are Hol Chetam? Simple people. Simple people that say, this is what Hashem tells me to do, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to stay away from the bad stuff. I'm going to stick to the good stuff. I'm not going to risk anything. Right? I'll try to keep my foot on first base while I go to second base. Right? And sometimes that's difficult. It's hard to be simply faithful, especially in a world which is surrounded by things that are not so faithful. Right? But this is what the end of the pasuk says, that the person like this, Hashem is going to be magen l'chol chetam. Those who walk simply will be protected. Hashem is going to, if he deserves it, he's going to keep them away from bad things. Magen l'chol chetam means he's going to protect them from being affected by all these terrible influences because he knows that this is a holy tam. He's walking simply. It's not necessarily part of him. He doesn't have the same moral compass as the yashar, as the person who walks straight on his own. But he's nonetheless someone worthy of protection from Hashem. And you can obviously understand this as a progression, that someone might start off as a tam and develop into a yashar, but hopefully in our own lives, whether we have created the moral compass or whether we are simply walking in the ways of Hashem, we will also be protected and blessed. And Mirz Hashem, we will continue the other benefits of these wisdoms, according to Shlomo Melech, next week. Shkaya for coming. Have a great night.
Thank you. He's not heavy, he's my brother.